Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, the Free Markets series. One of our regular contributors is back, Reuven Brenner, the McGill economist who writes in Forbes and the Wall Street Journal, and who penned this fascinating book, The Force of Finance, The Triumph of Capital Markets. So we asked him precisely that. Let's talk about the link between free markets and financial markets, how one needs or does not need, depends or does not depend on the other. Contracts, rule of law, all of that. Let's revisit it. Here's what Reuven had to say. Reuven Brenner, we're doing free markets today in your book, The Force of Finance. We're not doing your defense of gambling and betting and so on, which we did last time, which was highly entertaining. But free markets are about creativity as well. That's one of your leitmotifs. And you believe, if I read you correctly, that without free markets, the whole structure of democracy and the whole structure of property rights and rule of law, none of it can hold together unless you have the freedom to transact and for people's creativity to express itself.
Yes, that I agree. Now, there is a big difference between saying that and executing it. And the question is how you move towards such a situation when the political institutions and others are not adjusted. If, let's say, let me give a concrete example. When you have a big innovation, and I would say the last 20 years, we had two major innovations. One was political, the other technology. The political one was that communists fell, borders opened, there were 12 countries, the Western democracies, which during those years that the rest of the world was isolated from them, found a kind of good, stable way to solve the problems between rule of law, private property, creativity, allowing people to try many things that they wanted. They set the rules of the game, so it was relatively a stable environment in these 12 countries to experiment.
European,
U.S., Canada, Australia, and Japan, the few Western-type democracies. Then suddenly you had a major transformation when suddenly Russia, China, India, Latin America, part of Latin America, stabilized and suddenly they got opened. So the question is then, if everybody is talking about globalization, but globalization means coordination. These countries don't have the institutions to promote the creativity that is needed or the innovations. They don't have courts. They don't have a tradition of legal rules. They don't have the political institutions to induce negotiations and cooperation. What distinguished the 12 Western democracies is that they found ways, political institutions, and the way the law was applied by the courts to diminish the transaction cost needed for what we call free markets to operate. Because free markets essentially means freedom to contract. Now, the moment I say the word contract, immediately implies that you must have trust, you must have courts, you must have ways to appeal, you must have contracts immediately mean private property. At the same time, even in the Western societies, the private rules are not absolute because everywhere there are bad apples, there is crime, there are threats of war, so something must be taxed. Mm-hmm. So once you accept, but so the question is how you navigate between, yes, maintaining private property, yes, maintaining, lowering as much as possible the cost of entering into contracts exactly to innovate. You need that. Otherwise, you cannot do it. There is no, because, well, take your industry of, let's say, entertainment or movie and so forth. You are making a movie. It's an R&D. You are contracting the scriptwriters, the actors, the mm-hmm. studios, and so forth. From the 100 movies made, maybe two are successful and have to cover for the 98 other mistakes. And then the question is, what does it mean, 98 other mistakes? Some of the companies go bankrupt, so then you must have rules who are being paid there. So every innovation, whenever you make an innovation, by definition, it's an experiment.
So free markets are not anarchy. They're the opposite. They're actually a very intricate organization.
Absolutely. So they need this huge background of institutions to induce cooperation, because otherwise you don't have the trust necessary to make contracts. Now, so here we are today. The 12 Western countries which had these institutions suddenly are trading with all the rest of the world who doesn't have them. Now, maybe slowly they are involving some of them, not all of them, as we see today in the news with Argentina and and Venezuela. But let's say that they are evolving. This is a very long transition. You cannot just move from no rule of law and no institutions to facilitate people to negotiate, to even think in that way, suddenly to move into that frame of mind and to have the credible institutions to do it. So that actually, if you think globally now, what it would require is a leadership to explain, to coordinate these things with the other countries and so forth. But that's not what is happening. It's almost a kind of adversarial situation. And yes, there is an increase in trade and so forth. But take a look what's happening about the discussion with currencies. Everybody under different name is playing a kind of devaluation game because they think that this is what will restore their competitive advantage rather than dealing with the fundamentals. So I would say that this is one of the reasons that, let's go back again to the Western countries, the employees here were adjusted since human capital, the brains, financial capital, until 20 years ago, they were all coming to these Western countries, exactly because of that stability. So what that meant, and the entrepreneurs and so forth, they knew that they were stuck in these 12 countries. Nowhere else could they realize their dreams. So in a way, you could tax these people and the capital at a much higher rate at the time that you can do now when suddenly more countries are open to trade and people can move there.
And entrepreneurs and springing up in India.
And even, entrepreneurs are springing up and moving back to India, also from Silicon Valley. So, plus, the people there are, let's say, equally qualified technicians, equally qualified engineers as those who, let's say, worked in the US, in Canada, in Western Europe. They are ready to work at much lower wages. Here, these people could have extracted higher wages, even if their skills by now don't justify that. They could extract it because they knew that the financial capital and the smart people couldn't move anywhere. That's why people who say now in the political debate that somehow we can go back to the rates of taxation of, let's say, when Thatcher came to power, the marginal rate of taxes on, and it started pretty early on the rich, were 95, I think it was above 95%. That's why
in Sweden it was, yeah.
Yeah, but in England it was. That's why Beatles and everybody else moved, and the Canadian universities were full of British scientists because they escaped this taxation.
But I can understand that it's painful for the OECD countries, as you say, Western, as you call them, the developed countries who had kind of a monopoly on freedom. It's funny to talk like that, but in a way that's what it is, and the advantages of it. It's painful now to suddenly have all these competitors, but for the notion of freedom worldwide and free markets, isn't that necessary? That's how it has to happen. They are becoming more like us, even though we don't like it initially, but it's good, isn't it?
Well, I would say it was good if it was true. But I don't think... Take, for example, China. You know, we discussed this many times. Political or any other innovations happen when push comes to shove. People don't change their ways until they fear bankruptcy or default or something bad happens. And the same thing is true for governments. So let's take a look at China. Yes, obviously they liberalized because they knew that they are becoming poorer by the day with their increasing population. But the Communist Party still wants itself in power. They really, when we speak about freedom to experiment, well, first of all, you need different competitive financial sources to be able to do that. Well, you don't have that in China so much. I mean, still, the banks are controlled by the government, and they don't allow kind of new financial powers to arise. They still want to control it. So yes, to some extent they liberalize, that's why they are doing better, but they still want to keep themselves in mm-hmm. power. So what you said, yes, it's accurate. So, but it's not happening at the speed that would be, and that's why we are in such a mess. It's not happening at the speed because they don't allow the creation of those institutions to induce the cooperation, to finance, to be really, you see, that word freedom has a meaning only if you have options. If I don't have an option.
No, and you're picking the prime example. China is extremely authoritarian despite its liberalized economy. But Chile went through an economic revolution and it has worked to some extent. The Chinese have laid their hands off Hong Kong.
Yes.
So, I mean, there are good examples,
absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are. At the same time, in the West, all these groups who had relatively high incomes, yes, it is a problem for them because their power was significantly diminished. So how you deal, you see, when economists deal about this, mention these models of free markets, it is an implicit assumption in their models that if you have an innovation of any type and some people lose their jobs or you open a country to freer trade and so forth, whoever gains from it transfers that to those who lost.
Mm-hmm. Well, creative destruction.
Yes, but that doesn't happen really because it's not the West is not properly adjusted in terms of institutions to somehow compensate those people who fell behind and give them another chance. Mm-hmm. It's also, unfortunately, this whole transition is also happening when Western Europe in particular and Japan are finding themselves with a massive demographic shift and older population. So when this change happens and suddenly you have somebody 50, 55, 60 losing their traditional jobs, well, what do you do? It's at that moment it is pretty difficult to make the adjustment. So it is, that's why we have, and I would say, all these big problems, both in the West. I would say the problems would have been much easier solved if, let's say, China opened faster. If it opened internally faster, because then the people there would be more entrepreneurial, there would be more mm-hmm. experiments, the demand for U.S. things would, their wages there would increase faster. The same thing about India. I picked the two countries with the biggest population
yeah,
masses.
Of course.
There, it's the bureaucracy that is strangling that places, and it's also moving at the deregulations and so forth, move at a glacial pace.
Yeah.
So we have today all this kind of, how would I call it, frictions, huge frictions, if you want, and unfortunately, it's the leadership that is missing, that doesn't pursue the right policies, and I think that the biggest void is this leadership, and so you don't have the trust that people have. Yes, we can adjust these institutions, and yes, we can stabilize. I'll give you an example. Let's say the U.S. should have pushed much more, let's say China, one way or another, to try to open it internally. The U.S. had enough negotiating power, I believe, to do it.
No, well, I think the Chinese sent many signals, lay off and mind your own business, and they've been very firm.
Yeah, well, yes, but look what's happening now. Now they have their they are afraid of hard landing. Yes, they are. If you look what happened the last few months, yes, they are doing it. I think the U.S. made a lot of mistakes. They could have forced that changes much earlier on them. Okay.
But let me give you a source of optimism, perhaps. Among these frictions and these, let's call them resistances to a true free market, normally when these things happen, these innovations, or when you get rigidities because labor costs are too high, economists will assume that over time labor costs will come down because people have no choice. Yes. They'll take the lower paying jobs. In the U.S., in Canada, there's tremendous resistance through the unions and elsewhere. But we are seeing in states like North Carolina, right-to-work states, people taking salaries that they wouldn't have taken before, and that's probably to the good.
Absolutely.
It's no fun, but it's to the good. Caterpillar in Indiana was able to convince its workers to work for far less. That's unfortunate on one level, but on another level, Caterpillar is still providing jobs in Indiana.
Absolutely.
Those things indicate
Robert,
a change.
The fact that you gave these two examples, it just shows how rare it is. Because if it was, overall, then...
But it might be the beginning of something, is
yes,
my point.
It will happen, absolutely. The problem is that, meanwhile, the way the countries are doing it, and I think this is a huge danger, is that they try to achieve this not by the caterpillars and the negotiations, exactly what I alluded to, and to show this is how we must deal with it, but through competitive devaluation. Because under different names, the US can call it QE and the dollar is dropping, the Europeans are pushing money into their banks and then the euro then is dropping, Japan is printing money, then the yen is dropping. China tried to do a lot of times through through their own way. This is the problem, because once you do that, then unfortunately one of the things that can happen is trade wars, and then we are in a mess. That's why exactly I agree with you completely. The Caterpillar and these few isolated examples.
Yes,
this is exactly what I said at the beginning. These are the type of negotiations and institutions that should have taken place, because this is the real thing, and this is what fundamentally, but I give you what I mean, that the US didn't do the right things. They pushed a lot of money into banks. Well, what happened in the US because of that huge mistake that they overinvested, and so many people worked in the real estate sector, a lot of capital, in a way, what people expected to be capital, got destroyed, okay? And they remained with a lot of debt. So you have to then restore equity in that country. Now, you don't restore equity through entrepreneurs. Banks don't give loans to entrepreneurs because they cannot. Entrepreneurs are not backed by anything. I understand you had a guest here who spoke about how he went bankrupt and then he went into the fireman.
That's right. Yeah.
So you see, nobody who would give him...
No, for sure. He wasn't his family and everybody.
Exactly.
Helped
it's the family, friends, angel, venture capital. Now, to do that, actually, you have to lower capital gains taxes. But they turned this whole capital gains issue in the U.S. as if it's a range in the poor. And yet, lowering that tax allows experimentation. Because from the 100 experiments, two succeed. So those two must pay for the 98 failures. And banks cannot give loan. Everybody is saying, oh, the big banks are sitting on the money. Yes, they are sitting on the money because they would never give to, they cannot.
But it's hard to imagine that a country like the United States, despite all these problems, with all the talent, the human capital, as you call it, that is there, that it's just going to accept its fate and sit there and drift.
Yeah.
I mean, that economy will roar back. We just don't know how.
Well, it will come back. I don't know if roar. That depends on. I wish it roared, but
no. But I mean,
it's that.
I mean, look at the level of education is high. The level of economic experience is high. They have more multinationals still than any other country.
Yes, and
you can't imagine. It's like having a motor that has some knocks in it, but it's a nice big car.
Robert.
I mean, it can go boom.
Yes,
I think anyway.
But I'll give you some numbers. If you look at the stock market in the U.S. between, I think, 64 and 82, it didn't move. 18 years. That was a long time. Okay,
yeah.
So, and the U.S. got at the time a lot of capital, so these things can happen. But I think that the world still believes that the U.S. will correct its mistakes faster than anybody else, and that's why the U.S. can still borrow in spite of all the difficulties at zero interest, where the rest of the world has to pay through their nose. However, what you mentioned, education, I think...
No, I realize there I'm stretching it a bit. They've fallen behind quite a bit.
Well, no, but it's I would say it is much worse than that, because if you ask me now what is the other big blunder that's happening in the U.S. or the next big bubble to explode, I think it's quote-unquote education, because they eliminated that notion of selection. I mean, whether it is how you advance to high school, whether or not how you accept you are accepted to universities. If you look at the data here in Quebec is that 55% of boys don't finish high school.
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., 40% who arrive to universities don't finish it within 6 years. And I would say they shouldn't be there, yet everybody is talking with education, which in my view in the last two, 3 decades, it became a kind of factory of pieces of paper to a large extent. So I would not confuse, I would not confuse statistical education with the real education. And the problem there is, we see it a little bit in this province, that it leads to expectations as if that piece of paper guarantees you a wonderful future.
Okay. Forget about it. Well, I'm still looking for a silver lining, so I'm going to go back to something you wrote about the freedom to transact, which is, of course, part of free markets, and the creativity that this generates and so on. And you have an amusing sentence. You say, take, for instance, Hollywood. Every gas any gas station you stop at, somebody has a script to sell you. It's a very transactional society.
Yes.
The freedom and the creativity are there.
Yes.
And that is a key, that the soul of free markets is there. Because as you also point out, if you sit on your wealth, you haven't transacted and you haven't created any.
Well, you see, that was the problem. That was the mistake in my view. And it started with good intentions in the U.S. with the real estate, what happened, because there were a lot of these academic theories that if people live in their own homes, it stabilizes the communities and so forth. But that depended that you really had equity stake in those homes, not that you just gave it for nothing and zero. But what it caused, and it was done inadvertently, I believe in 1998, Clinton passed that capital gains from homes, but from nothing else, if you have $750,000, will be exempt of capital gains. So, of course, a lot of resources and employment and people went into this real estate, which is, as you just mentioned, you are just sitting on it if you cannot leverage it. And now it's not leveraged. So that is a huge correction that still has to, and a huge adjustment that still has to be done. The example, I'm glad you reminded me. I forgot that thing about the gas station
and in
Hollywood and the actresses who are all waitresses. So you have a wonderful time. You see wonderful women, you know, in the restaurants. But actually, that's a lottery type of business, because all of them know that
all the
chances of a script or this waitress of being the next Julia Roberts or whoever, well, are as much as we can win him in the 649. So,
no, of course. No, in that sense, no. But if we cast our if we look at our crystal ball and cast ahead, free markets will have progressed in the next 5 years worldwide or not? Your prediction?
I would say a lot depends on it's on political leadership. It's, that's why I think that you have this huge volatility today. Hollande is promising you 75% to increase the capital gains to 75%, to nationalize I don't know what else. So it's going there, it's going in the opposite direction. Greece, it doesn't have any, except tourism, it doesn't have anything. It's a nice real estate, you know, for vacations. But vacations depend on how the other countries are doing. They have absolutely no industry, nothing, okay, except tourism. So Europe, I would say they accumulated a lot of mistakes, and it's in a mess, and they don't have the political leadership.
But could we go back to, if we don't move forward to more free markets, what are we going to? Lots of protectionism, like in the 30s?
And I would say this is the danger. That's what I said about the currency, because unfortunately that's the policy for the moment that it's pursued. They have not done the fundamental fiscal and regulatory changes to encourage that movement, or even change the institutions to even understand that this is where we have to, that to induce more contracts and more collaboration and more cooperation and to induce trust, I would say. People, you look at even the US, I mean, you ask people regularly in all these polls, whom do they mistrust most? Well, politicians come together with the mafia, roughly, at the bottom of the scale. So that means that there is there is no trust in the institutions as they are managed today. And unfortunately, I expected it with President Obama because he didn't have any life experience. He never worked a day in his life before he became
president.
Watch out
with that sentence.
Why?
It's a dangerous sentence. No.
Well, we are in dangerous territory.
I'm just teasing you. But you therefore do not believe that the economy can make progress even while the political sector is stagnant.
It can, but it will be, look, as long as the Western governments and the U.S. pursue this kind of competitive devaluation, just to come to very narrow, because they impose so much weight on the monetary issues to solve the problems, that it may end up in a trade war inadvertently. They think that they are doing good things, but that's only for the moment. It's only because they are avoiding the tough decisions. They try to do through the monetary things that are unachievable, and it may end up very badly. Now, that's why I'm saying it goes back to leadership and somebody getting there out and explaining what's at stake. But it's almost hope, you know, to get. I don't see that leadership at present nowhere.
Well, Ruben, well, we only have one way to go, and that's up.
Absolutely.
And we'll revisit that in a few weeks.
Thanks so much, Robert. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Ruben Brenner was our guest this week on the Free Markets series of the World Show. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.